This is SG2 Perspectives, a conversation with SG2 experts and industry thought leaders about the biggest trends in healthcare and what we expect that's going to mean for the future of healthcare delivery. We're always looking for new ideas and topics from our listeners, so please reach out, share your ideas. You can email us at sg2perspectives@sg2.com or connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter, and you can find links to all that in the show notes. Now, on to this week's episode.
The thing about living through a crisis is it's a clarifying event, and it helps you really clarify what is central to my identity, my strategy, and what's a distraction.
Welcome to SG2 Perspectives. I'm your host, Trevor Durin, and today we have another conversation in our series around financial strategy. I have three colleagues with me who spend their time talking with our members about these topics, and I wanted to have them here to talk about some of kind of the emerging new things we're hearing. And my understanding is recent conversations have kind of gravitated towards new dynamics in payer contracting. So that's going to be our focus for today. And then there's a few other tangential things that have come up in conversations with financial leaders. With me today to help us walk through this are Steve Jenkins, longtime SG2 senior thought leader and a voice and name many of you probably recognize, Brian Esser, who leads our financial strategy practice, and Rich Daly, who's one of the members of our finance team. Let's get started with what, if anything, has changed fundamentally in payer contracting due to COVID-19? There was a lot of speculation over the summer that open enrollment and discussions with payers could be a lot different this year. What did it really look like? What's changed? What are people expecting going forward? Steve, why don't you kick us off?
Sure, Trevor. What we're hearing from members is that in terms of impact of COVID on payer contracting, little, if anything, has fundamentally changed. Certainly middle of last year, there was a lot of activity to secure cash flow when hospitals were virtually shut down. And there's a sense of focus and clarity now in contracting to ensure that the deals that our members are making can ensure a strong cash flow in the months and years ahead. And there's a lot of non-COVID related forces in payer contracting. But in terms of COVID specifically, how you approach contracting, the nature of the negotiation, fundamentals are fundamentals.
Brian, you agree?
Yeah, I totally agree with Steve, and Steve's a veteran of the space, so I can't go against what he said. But I think there are two really fundamental nuances going into 2021 that historically haven't been there. Number one is the introduction of price transparency in the rule that passed last year and came into effect early January of this year, requiring hospitals to post both their gross and payer negotiated prices. And an easy-to-read 300 shoppable service format, which we all have heard about, but even more significant is that machine-readable file that really discloses their entire book of business. So how does that transparency data get leveraged by the payers and even more so by the employers and the consumers themselves? And then secondarily is this idea of the digital frontier. What does virtual health, telehealth, all of that space between the payer and the provider look like? And as you begin your negotiations, what does that mean? Does that cause you to think about things differently? Should you be willing to cede certain things historically that you wouldn't have to get a foot in the door in the virtual? And who's really going to own that space moving forward?
Rich, anything you've heard that's different than those themes?
Yeah, and a couple of secondary effects we've seen from the pandemic is some more push from health systems for shorter terms for these new contracts. They really want 3 years max, and actually payers are telling us that they are open to more limited durations, some including 1 year extensions of existing contracts with minimal changes in order to accommodate the uncertainty and the financial strains that are on their health system partners. Another secondary effect is in the ongoing and continued conflicts over site neutral and prior authorization policies. Some health plans have told us that they're able to use or get a little leverage from their data on COVID adverse effects on the health system in their ongoing discussions with payers.
All right, let's dig deeper into several of those things that you guys mentioned. First, what's been some of the speculation you've heard about maybe the potential pain points and potentially some advantages around the new mandates for transparency?
I'll kick that off. You know, transparency, not surprising per se. We've seen this coming. There's been a push by CMS and others saying we want more data out there to really, in theory, give consumers the data they can to be shopping, but really recognizing there's a Medicare trust fund issue and we need to bring prices down. But this becomes quickly, and we've been hearing from our CFO members that price transparency is the number one issue they're facing in 2021, at least the most concerning issue. And how do you really approach that? We're hearing anywhere from 60 to 75% of members are complying in some way, but full compliance is really varied across the board. And really, there's that fear of, should I be a first mover in my market, put my rates up, and what does that do among my competitors? And does that give them a leg up? And or what are the insurers going to do with that data? And will that show up in our negotiations this year? And we've already heard anecdotal evidence that is showing up. Everything from it's been mentioned casually in negotiations to I've been asked by my insurer to open up my entire contract based on the price transparency data. So it is a real concern and one that's quickly becoming a reality in the market.
And I'd note that there are potential benefits health systems have mentioned to us. And those can come from comprehensively comparing in each market they operate in their own negotiated rates with those of their competitors. Health systems plan to use relatively low rates when they find them in their upcoming negotiations with their payers. And even when they find that in a given market they have the highest rates, that type of analysis can prepare them so that they have time to develop a defensive strategy along the lines of things like quantifying their larger relative footprint or whether they provide high need services in those specific markets. So really doing some homework and understanding where you stand may be a key response to the transparency policies.
Yeah, clearly the law that took effect January 1st is just one step in a long journey toward greater price transparency. I think one of the fallacies of this topic, it's talked about as a tool for consumer shopping and in a very limited set of circumstances for a very limited set of clinical services. Maybe so. But principally, transparency is about arming employers and payers, and in some cases, as Rich mentioned, health systems with data that they can use as a weapon to inform their negotiations. And clearly, payers and employers are looking to use this data as a cudgel. But there's both offense and defense to be played for health systems, depending on their position in the market with regard to price.
Steve, you've been in the market and you're dealing with both providers that have the market penetration and maybe clout and those that do not. How would you educate or counsel a large player in a market, market share dominant, and they know that their prices are probably better than most? What's their positioning on this versus one who may be underpriced or not have that advantageous position?
Their argument is what it's always been, that look, we're the essential provider in this market. If you want to sell insurance benefits, insurance policies to employers, you got to have us in our network. You know, if you have a quality and customer experience story to tell, that improves your argument. But being an essential part of any insurance network is still powerful.
One other place where getting, and we probably have better data now than we've ever had before, is around digital health and especially direct-to-consumer virtual health after the rapid growth last year. But this really led to just a turf war between payers and providers around the digital front door, right? How are health system finance leaders thinking about investments here? What are you hearing in terms of where people are making their bets?
It really depends on the health system. We're finding strategies all over the place. In terms of the two main categories of how do you either use it to increase revenue or control costs, we're finding some demonstrated success in both areas. For instance, there was a health system that developed during the pandemic a browser-based application that integrated its enterprise scheduling system and EHR. And that was able to triage patients for in-person versus virtual. That system cost them $200,000 and it saved them $3 million in the span of 6 months. On the revenue generation side, some smaller and rural hospitals have expanded their teleconsult capability, and that has allowed them to bring in specialists and retain some high revenue care services that would otherwise be patients that they're forwarding on to tertiary centers and able to obtain some real revenue benefits from those kinds of approaches.
And specifically with regard to payer contracting, there's a lot of concern that insurers are going to pull back reimbursement for digital encounters. In many cases, that's already happened. I think there's a real opportunity, though. We had this unique experiment in the middle of 2020 where we opened up the gates and had this tremendous groundswell of new digital encounters. I think there's an opportunity to engage our payer partners, share with them the data about how we use digital health, where did it work, where did it not work, from a clinical point of view, where did it replace an in-person encounter, or maybe was it duplicative? Obviously, they're concerned about overutilization. Maybe you need to have that conversation at a different level. So maybe it's not a negotiator-to-negotiator conversation, payer and provider, but I think there's a real opportunity there.
Yeah, and building on those opportunities, because we hear, obviously, concerns about fraud and abuse within virtual, and are we duplicating visits, or is this really an individual, unique visit that is necessary and appropriate? But there are areas of partnership, at least on the payer side. They're interested in rural access and other areas like that where they know that they can't serve their populations effectively, and they want to partner with provider to reach out to different cohorts of population. So that's a different way to think through it. And then secondarily, I guess the bigger concern is who's really going to own this digital area? Because we see the payers investing in virtual and telecoms. You have the independent third-party companies out there. And how do you invest appropriately or not? Is it really more of a partnership play? And then turning around and saying, look at the offering that we can produce, and this is going to help us manage our overall cost and expenditure to the payer, versus them coming in and sort of leaping upstream and really steering their patients more aggressively via the virtual facets. So that's sort of the discussion we have and we think is going to be important. And third consideration is, what does that do to your footprint? You have urgent care that might be slightly depressed due to virtual uptake. We hear the EDs are down, especially freestanding. What does that mean? And how do you continue to invest your capital in those areas? So what is the overall front door access? And how does virtual impact those negotiations as well?
Around physician group strategy, last summer, we were speculating and we heard others speculating that more groups would be in financial distress and probably the calculation about remaining independent would change. It's March now. I haven't heard a huge wave of provider acquisitions by health systems. I've kind of heard the opposite, that health systems are changing their thinking about that. What are you hearing, Brian?
It seems like there was enough funding from the government through 2020 to keep majority of systems and provider groups, at least in business. But the question moving forward now is, what does that employed group especially look like? We know the subsidy per physician is still astronomical, let's say $200,000 on average. And what does that mean moving forward? And should you continue to carry that subsidy, knowing that items like virtual are out there, you have disruption coming from different players in the industry, focus on the primary care space, and does it make sense to continue to carry that subsidy forward? Or should we look at different options? Is partnering with independents the right move? We've seen partnerships emerge across the national front, not just due to the pandemic. So what is the different ways to play, and where should you be placing your bets and your dollars on the physician alignment space?
We've heard this kind of expanding dynamic of prior auth went away for a while. Well, we now have data to understand how that impacted care patterns and outcomes. At the same time, payers are pushing for direct access to provider EMR systems. There's new elements in the negotiation here, Steve. How should provider systems think about leveraging that?
We're already hearing from our members that insurers are snapping pre-auth back in place after the great relaxation of rules in 2020. We had this great experiment for a period of months in 2020 where pre-auth was relaxed. And I think there's an opportunity to look at the data. Where did that have an impact on utilization? Where did it not have an impact? And is there a dialogue to be had with an insurer about, well, let's bring back pre-auth in these clinical circumstances, but not maybe in this other set? And we can save both of us a lot of time and money and aggravation.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm anxious to hear the product of some of those conversations.
I'm not hearing them happen yet, but I think there's an opportunity there. So it's a bit of a challenge to our members.
One other thing continues to be more aggressively discussed is allowing payers access to the EMR so they could get ahead of that pre-auth and maybe streamline a bit, which in theory makes sense, reduces maybe the burden on your workforce, but there is a negotiation point there to allow that access or not, and what is the downstream benefit of that. So more to come there, but I would expect more of that entanglement to occur.
At least some health systems have successfully gotten plans to allow them to replace components of their prior authorization with a health system-based pre-approval process, where it felt like the health system was using a sufficient tool to really determine when that's needed versus not. All these kind of efforts aside, it's probably important to mention that a lot of health systems don't broadly view fighting this across the board as worth the fight. It's something that health plans seem very intent on pushing further, and it's not generally seen as a broadly winnable fight.
That's a good way to frame it, Rich. That makes a lot of sense. I'm going to come back to you with another emerging area of concern. The ACA subsidies could change how both employers and individuals think about those products, and it could change the payer mix somewhat substantially as people shift into now more viable ACA products. Talk about what kind of the national projections are and how local systems are thinking about the impact.
Right. There's a lot of hope around the effects of the emerging legislation on this that will increase subsidies and expand them to a larger share of the population. The reality check on this can be found in the Congressional Budget Office's projections on the effect of this expanded ACA marketplace spending. The CBO finds that 1.3 million fewer uninsured would result, 300,000 fewer with non-group coverage purchased outside of the marketplaces, and 100,000 fewer with employment employment-based coverage. It's important that CBO expects a limited effect on employer-based coverage because these subsidies are temporary. They expire at the end of 2022. CBO expects the result will be that a lot of employers are not going to look to move their employees to ACA marketplace coverage in favor of offering their own insurance. So those caveats need to be understood to understand the effect of this policy change, both on employer coverage and on the patients health systems are expecting to see.
Yeah, markets hate uncertainty, and this provision has an 18-month time bomb built into it. And who knows who's in charge of Congress in 2023.
I also feel like it's tough to expect employer benefit and HR departments to understand the nuance here and really see if there's an opportunity to move into group ACA product, especially like you said, for a short term. So this episode is called Stories from the Field. Naturally, the stories aren't going to necessarily weave together perfectly, but I'll force you guys to try to do that. Weave a few of these pieces together. What does this all mean? In the introduction, you agreed not much has fundamentally changed, but I do hear several new pieces that weren't top of mind in conversations with payers this time last year. Steve, what does this all mean?
The last year, we've all been heads down, right? We've lived through a crisis. We've all been heads down by necessity. And the result of all that focus is incredible, right? Lives saved, institutional muscle built, esprit de corps within our clinical teams. Our clinical teams are also exhausted and inwardly focused. Right now is the time to kind of raise your gaze again. Look out. What are the forces shaping your market, your environment in the months and years ahead? The thing about living through a crisis is it's a clarifying event. And it helps you really clarify what is central to my identity, my strategy, and what's a distraction. We would encourage you to have a dialogue with your leadership team, your board, about what do we double down on and what are those distractions? What's sucking our time and capital that we need to put aside?
Steve's absolutely right. As you think about the things we've hit on between price transparency, prior auth, and maybe site neutrality, virtual, is this overall compression and push towards the ambulatory space and this need to rein in costs. You know, SG2 called the shift towards ambulatory years ago, if not 10 years ago, but it's really going to hit full force this year and really gain that momentum because the patients don't want to show up at your acute care sites. They're still hesitant due to COVID. You know, they don't necessarily want to go to the freestanding ED or urgent care. They want to access the care where they want and pay the price that they feel is appropriate. So that kind of push towards ambulatory and overall compression of revenue will continue. And that pivot must really be in your strategy over the next 3 to 5 years.
And I'd also highlight the transparency push really has emerged this year as a long-term issue. The broad expectation among payers and providers is, despite the saber rattling from CMS and incoming HHS Secretary Javier Becerra, that they're going to be pushing hard on this and maybe looking at more penalties. It's broadly seen as this is going to be rolling out over years. It'll have a cumulative effect as its transparency from organizations increases and it's increasingly used by health systems and third-party vendors to roll it in and disperse it widely to both employer and commercial payers and secondarily to the actual patients. It's important to lay the groundwork and prepare for an ongoing and expanded role and effect on this so health systems can maximize their position as it continues to roll out.
Well, thanks to all three of you. We covered a lot of ground, and I'm trying to ask you to come up with a perspective on emerging trends on the fly here. So I appreciate your thoughtful judgment and managing your expectations and tempering what could be seen as huge new trends. So thanks for being realistic about what these could mean and how provider systems can try to react.
This has been another episode of SG2 Perspectives. If you like what you are hearing, please subscribe and don't forget to rate and review. We'd love to hear from you. Please connect with us on LinkedIn or Twitter at SG2 Healthcare. You can also reach us via email at sg2perspectives@sg2.com. Reach out and let us know what healthcare trends are most important to you. Please also listen and subscribe to our colleague, Dr. Tom Villanueva's Modern Practice podcast on Vizient's Medical Leadership Channel. Tom discusses key healthcare trends through the clinical leadership lens. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening.